This is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com. Listen to us on KPFK, KPFA, and other Pacific affiliates, and watch us on Free Speech TV Monday through Friday at 3 p.m. Pacific, 6 p.m. Eastern. A gathering of white nationalists in Washington, D.C. garnered major news coverage as Nazi salutes and calls of Hail Trump rang aloud. White nationalism and supremacist views have begun flaunting themselves openly with the Electoral College victory of Donald Trump. Many have taken cover under the innocuous label of alt-right. Is the U.S. sliding towards fascism? And if so, how do we gird ourselves and our communities in these dark times? Joining me now from Austin, Texas, where a so-called White Lives Matter rally recently resulted in a clash in front of the state capitol, is Robert Jensen, professor of journalism at the University of Texas at Austin, author of numerous books that we've featured on this show, including Arguing for Our Lives, A User's Guide to Constructive Dialogue, and We Are All Apocalyptic Now, on the responsibilities of teaching, preaching, reporting, writing, and speaking out. He's a frequent guest on this program. Welcome back, Bob.
Great to be with you, Sonali.
So first, let's talk about this rally that took place in Austin. I understand it was basically at the unveiling of an African-American memorial at the state capitol that Governor Greg Abbott was present for. There were a lot of Black Lives Matter folks, and then some folks carrying a sign that said that signs that say White Lives Matter showed up.
Yeah, so they did unveil this memorial, which had nothing to do with the election cycle at all. And state officials, such as our governor, who's a conservative Republican, were there to honor the memorial and what it symbolized. A white nationalist group had called that rally for after the unveiling. They weren't picketing the memorial or anything. And then an even bigger crowd of people rejecting white supremacy showed up. So this is Austin, Texas. It's a liberal bubble in an otherwise very reactionary state. So it wasn't surprising that in Austin, the critics of white supremacy outnumbered the rally for white supremacy. There were some scuffles, a few people arrested, but it didn't amount to much.
And some of the signs that these white nationalists were holding were basically calling for repeal of hate crimes laws. I'm assuming that's because they want to be able to commit hate crimes and not be held accountable. I mean, what else can you read into it?
Well, no, it's because the only real minority group anymore is white Christian heterosexual men, and they have to be protected, Sonali. I don't think you understand that. So, yeah, of course, why would one call for repeal of hate crimes laws? Well, not necessarily because you want to go out and start committing violent acts, but it's symbolic. It's symbolic that the culture, a deeply white supremacist culture, has at least acknowledged that that kind of violence directed at people of color and other groups that are vulnerable is unacceptable in civilized society. And the kind of forces unleashed by the election of Trump in the campaign now see an opening to try and repeal some of that. Now, some of this is really important, such as voter suppression laws, which we're still fighting here in Texas. Those can change the real political realities. And some of it is merely symbolic. So I don't think we'll see a repeal of hate crimes laws. But what we do see is white people in these white nationalist groups who are working off of some sense of white racial resentment, some sense that the world has changed and they're no longer privileged. What we're seeing is them taking every opportunity, whether it's, you know, a white nationalist convention in D.C. or little outgrowths of this in places like Austin. What it will amount to is, of course, still up in the air. And the resistance is important because while one can look at these overtly white supremacist, racist, white nationalist, Christian identity movements, whatever we call them, and see them as kind of clownish in ways, I think given the national political climate, we can't afford to treat them as mere fringe characters anymore, obviously.
Right, Bob. In fact, there have been, far before the election of Trump or even the election campaign of Trump, such groups in cities around the country that occasionally rear their head. Here in Southern California, in Anaheim, we've had clashes. And these white supremacist neo-Nazi groups, you know, they're profiled by the Southern Poverty Law Center. They have not just come about recently. They've been around. But What seems to be a sort of new chapter is their ability to normalize, because right. Trump won, white nationalism as not something extremist and fringe, but as something legitimate. Is that where the danger lies?
Absolutely. Now, you know, for many, many years, folks like me who tried to point out that racism and white supremacy is not just a feature of fringe groups on the right, that the entire culture, all of America, is white supremacist in the sense that the distribution of wealth and power is still highly racialized. It's the product of history and contemporary practices. So for a lot of us who've been pointing out the fact that, you know, nice, polite white society, white liberal society, also is white supremacist in a sense. I at least used to say these groups on the fringe were concern, but not the main problem. Now I think you're pointing out they are back in the center, and we can't pretend they're merely fringe. You know, it's not just a group of white folks up in the mountains in Idaho with a lot of dried food and shotgun shells. It's a serious movement. Of course, people have been pointing out that you now have someone in the White House, Steve Bannon, a counselor to the president, who, if not an overt white supremacist himself, and you can argue what label to use for a guy like him, whether he's merely an opportunist or an actual ideologue, creating space, just like Trump. Is he a racist? Is he a white supremacist? Or is he just an opportunist? Well, in some sense, it doesn't matter, because the space created by these campaigns is now unleashing real ideologues and people who are really dangerous. Now, I'm a middle-aged white guy, and I don't feel a lot of threat to me personally. But in a bigger sense, I do feel that threat. And I think it's going to require people who look like me to not back down from that challenge.
In being questioned by the New York Times about Steve Bannon, Donald Trump said, "If I thought he was a racist or alt-right or any of the things, the terms we could use, I wouldn't even think about hiring him." And of course, you know, Trump, it's not at all surprising that he would deny any of this stuff, because he, throughout his campaign, has used coded terms, right, to refer to communities as being other without actually coming out and saying it. And then he's just been able to point to those isolated numbers of people of color supporting him to say, hey, I'm not a racist. So he does his deniability, does his denying of Bannon's racism mean anything?
No, of course not. You know, we used to have two kinds of white supremacist language. We had the overt white supremacy of groups like the Klan, and then we had what was often called the dog whistle code words, you know, things like law and order, which was a technique pioneered by Richard Nixon decades ago. It was understood to be a synonym for white supremacy, but it was truly coded. Now you have this group in the middle that, you know, people like Donald Trump, who don't say overtly racist things, such as, I believe white people are genetically superior to black people. That's not the kind of racism Donald Trump espouses. But he does talk about, you know, white people being put down, that the minority groups have somehow magically captured power. I don't know how they did that, because I haven't noticed it in my life.
Well, you know, Obama being president suddenly meant that all people of color were now in positions of power over whites, or at least this is the imagined reality.
Yeah, it's tapping into, again, this phrase that's being used regularly, this white racial resentment, this idea that white people naturally do belong on top. Whether you articulate it in crass racist terms or not, that's the underlying assumption. And not just of the alt-right, not just of, you know, these fringe groups. It's, I think, the underlying assumption of a whole lot of white America that, you know, history produced Europe as the dominant power. And if that happened, it must be because Europeans and the offshoots of Europe are somehow superior. Now, nobody says that out loud. But what Trump is doing is he's mining that room in the middle between really subtle coded dog whistle kind of terms and overt white supremacy with this kind of rhetoric that we don't really have a term for. Is it racist? Well, yeah, clearly it has racist overtones, and there will be racist results from it. But it doesn't look like the language of the old Klan. And so, you know, we need to start developing new ways of articulating this. You know, I hate to say it, but I'm kind of old fashioned. I just go back to the same core claim over and over again. The United States was, from its inception, a white supremacist nation. It remains white supremacist in the distribution of wealth and power today. that if the United States wanted to change that distribution of wealth and power, if it wanted to eliminate racialized disparities in virtually every measure of people's lives, then it certainly has the wealth and power to do that. It chooses not to. And I've asked over and over again for now a couple of decades, if we choose not to deal with those racialized disparities, is it not appropriate to say that the United States culture, and I don't just mean the fringe groups, I don't just mean the alt-right, I mean it may be, in fact, I believe it is accurate to describe all of U.S. culture as white supremacists. Now, that requires a conversation that takes more than a bumper sticker. And so, as is always the case, how are we going to create spaces where people can have these kind of conversations? That's as much, I think, part of the political struggle today as making the right claims, as where do those claims resonate? Where do we even find a place to articulate those claims? Social media, there's a lot of talk about the digital world as a place to do that. But I think this also means we have to reinvigorate face-to-face human connections. And that means not only political campaigns, it means community organizing of various kinds, including simply creating community spaces where real life humans show up face to face.
Now, Bob, earlier you said that, you know, no one actually comes out and says the sort of things that we imagine they're thinking. But Richard Spencer, the head of the National Policy Institute, this, you know, very boring sounding named white nationalist group, he was the one who was speaking in Washington, D.C. A few days ago, where the Nazi salutes and the calls of hail Trump, hail victory, hail our people came out. And he just basically said, quote, America was, until this last generation, a white country designed for ourselves and our posterity. It is our creation. It is our inheritance. And it belongs to us. He has literally called for, quote, peaceful ethnic cleansing. Those are his words. And he, in an interview with Reveal, said, fairness has never really been a great value in my mind. I like greatness and winning and dominance and beauty. Those are values, not really fairness. So you do have people just very openly saying such things. Yeah. And if so, should we try to engage them? Because I feel like that might be a waste of time.
Well, yeah. Now, again, Trump will disavow people like Spencer, but Spencer is out there and the ranks of the Spencer crowd are growing. And that is disturbing. In terms of, you know, rhetorical strategy, who are we trying to talk to? I think it's always important to remember that when one is debating with a very noxious political ideology like that, it can sometimes be effective to debate it, not because you think you're going to change the mind of the person you're debating or the committed ideologues with that point of view, but who you're really speaking to are people in the middle. So I'm very aware, you know, that often when I'm arguing with someone after a talk. Let's say I give a talk on this and there's a conservative, racist person who stands up and argues with me. I realize I'm not going to persuade that person. That's not my goal. My goal is to kind of flush out the underlying ideas that that person is rooted in to demonstrate to others in the audience that if you talk like him, here's who you are. So we have to remember that the subject of the debate, the other person we're debating, is not always the real target of our rhetoric. And to try to mark those kinds of ideas as reprehensible to somebody who wants to be part of civilized society. And one way to do that, of course, is just to talk about core values. So Richard Spencer talks about his core values, which sound very much like not only the alt-right, but as you were reading those quotes, it sounds like the Ayn Rand crowd, the harsh libertarian crowd as well, to remind us that it's not just white racial resentment fueling this. There's another kind of borderline psychotic ideology about capitalism and liberty out there as well. Lots of things to be worried about. But that's counter to all of the basic values of dignity, solidarity, equality that animate, you know, the basic secular philosophies and religious theologies of most decent people. So pointing out what Richard Spencer says is very useful to mark for regular people that they cannot go down that road without sacrificing some of their own values. And that's not me preaching to people what their values should be. That's me pointing out if people hold the values they claim to hold, they cannot traffic with these kinds of white nationalist, European supremacist, white supremacist ideas. It's simply inconsistent with your own values.
Bob, a side note before we get into another discussion, KUOW Radio in Seattle, a community radio station, put out an article recently saying we are not going to use the term alt-right anymore because this is the term that the alt-right has created for itself. We're going to say white nationalism. How important is it for us to sort of call out these groups as neo-Nazis, white nationalists, white supremacists, and maybe reject the term alt-right because the term alt-right kind of obscures what they are?
Yeah, well, you know, alt implies alternative. And after all, you know, we like things that are alternative. For instance, somebody might call your show alternative media, and that's
right.
A good thing. So I agree completely. The term alt-right never resonated for me. And I've been trying to avoid it except to reflect certain realities about the rhetoric. But I do think we do need a term. I think white nationalism is a good term for groups that espouse those kinds of ideas, because that's not me saying they're underlying white supremacists, which of course I think they are. But it's taking seriously their own rhetoric and just saying, okay, if that's your rhetoric, then it's fair, accurate to describe you as a white nationalist group. And then one can go forward and say, what are the ideas that have long animated white nationalism? Well, it's white supremacy. It's a certain set of ideas about the intrinsic superiority of some people. And so I like the idea of, in a sense, banishing the word alt-right. Now, we're not going to be able to avoid it completely because it's going to continue to circulate in other areas. But I think branding, how about that for using a nice, appropriate 21st century capitalist term? You know, branding the alt-right as white nationalist and leading to the obvious point that it's also white supremacist seems to me to be a good strategy.
So, Bob, let's end our conversation with another disturbing trend, which, you know, is really, I think we should consider related to the kinds of White Lives Matter, quote unquote, rally that we saw in Austin and the gathering in Washington, D.C., and that is the reemergence of so-called watch lists, the sort of blacklists of liberal professors like yourself. The right wing has for a long time been obsessed with this idea that college campuses are dangerous spaces where liberal ideas are, where young unsuspecting students are brainwashed with liberal ideas by people like yourself. There's a new list out now, and congratulations, you're on it. I almost wish somebody would offer me an adjunct position somewhere so that I could be on it too, but tell me about this list and why you're on it.
Well, these lists cropped up, especially after 9/11, when right-wing hysteria about this was back in play. I don't take them too seriously in one sense that I think they're mostly fundraising and publicity vehicles. That is, the people who create these lists, and this is by a new group led by a young up-and-coming right-winger, they know that there's not going to be any meaningful change as a result of this. But it's a great fundraising tool. It's a great way to get the base whipped up. Now, for that reason, I don't take it too seriously. The other reason I don't take it too seriously, of course, is I'm a tenured white guy. I mean, what do I have to worry about in some sense? What I do worry about is that even though at this moment, I don't really think it's going to cause a backlash against faculty, I do know that, for instance, women, people of color, untenured faculty who don't have all of my privileges, are much more vulnerable. And we should remember that look back at the 1950s, the anti-communist hysteria of the 1950s led to even tenured professors being fired for political reasons. So I think the protection I feel like I have here is pretty deeply embedded in contemporary university culture. But we should remember that that can flip very quickly.
Right.
For instance, one serious terror attack in the United States on the same scale as 9/11. And I think that embedded culture that respects freedom of expression and academic freedom might evaporate pretty quickly. So I don't want to be naive about it. But at the moment, there's no reason I feel threatened. But I do worry about some of, especially my younger colleagues. It's good to be vigilant about this, but also not rise to the bait, which, you know, the right wing also wants us to do. I'm taking a wait and see attitude on this most recent list.
Well, I'm proud to have you on our show. Several people who've been guests on my show, Chenjerai Kumanyika, one of our correspondents, is on that list. Gerald Horn, Melina Abdullah, both of them who are guests on our show have been on the list. Bill Ayers. In fact, I might use that list as a resource to find future good guests. Bob, you know, put Charles Kirk's work to good use. That's the young right-wing guy who's made this list. Bob, always a pleasure to have you on. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks, Sonali.
Robert Jensen is a professor of journalism at the University of Texas at Austin and author of a number of books, including Arguing for Our Lives and We Are All Apocalyptic Now. This is Rising Up with Sonali. I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com. We're also on Facebook at facebook.com/ruwithsonali.